Hi, Isabella.
Hello, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. And very excited to start talking with you again after a couple of weeks of a break. And I've got tons of things to talk with you about and ask you about. So I wondered if we could take a deeper dive into this idea of mental proliferation, or so many other words that we can use for that. I know that you have been reading a lot of sources and Buddhist texts around this idea, and I'd love for you to share, first of all, why you're interested in this idea, and then what you're learning.
Yeah, so the word that we're talking about is called papancha in Pali, and the more recent translations of it tend to go for something like mental proliferation. And the reason I got interested in it originally is to do with the dreaded dependent origination, which we've been talking about for some time, this Buddhist idea of conditionality and how the self or self-view comes into being in the momentary understanding of this topic. And in the term is used many times in the early suttas that are about dependent arising. And so the term is, it's not that it's difficult to translate, it's just that no one really knows for sure what it means, even though it's been used all over the place. And there's different guesses, things like obstruction, impediment, delay, or hindrance, but also it maybe this kind of prolific tendency or proliferation. And I think a lot of people have gravitated in recent decades to this translation of papancha as mental proliferation. So the kind of tendency of the mind when we have a concept to just kind of spiral out from that concept, just what we might call proliferation, or maybe rumination in normal speech, which is that, you know, I think a thought, that thought leads onto another thought, and then that thought leads onto another thought. And then after a little while, I'm in this kind of fantasy realm that may be quite stressful or depressing or, you know, in some way not helpful. And yet it's on some level entirely of our own making, right? So that's what I'm currently understanding by that mental proliferation.
Great. So I do think the reason why this topic fascinates me and so many others is that I think we tend to believe that we know what it means and what it's referring to. It seems basic in terms of, oh yeah, that's when I ruminate, I get myself into some kind of corner and I can't stop thinking about the same thing over and over again. And I am not really doing problem solving per se, because I keep thinking about it in the same way. It usually comes with emotions like anxiety or anger or frustration and so on. And in my world of psychology, the number one correlate to depression and anxiety, but specifically depression, is rumination. So you would think we've got, and we've got literally decades of work showing how important it is to stop rumination as early as possible in a context where you are having difficulty with depressive feelings and so on. So we think we know what that is. And from my discussions with you, it's starting to become very clear that there's so much more to know. And so this is why I wanted to start with this concept. And could you maybe tell me a few of the words that are often sort of translated into mental proliferation? I think you gave me a list of 10, 20 or something like that, just to give us a sense of how many things kind of go into this.
Oh, you mean potential other translations of papancha?
That's right.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, papancha, we don't know what it means, essentially. One of the things that it could mean is mental proliferation. It could also mean a lot of other things. So this mental proliferation idea kind of starts with this book, Concept and Reality in Early Buddhist Thought, which was written, I think, in 1971, although it might have been published a few years after that. And so this is where we start to get this idea that what's going on in that term is proliferation. So before that, people were thinking more like obsession could be one, impediment, delay, hindrance. So
just to give you a sense of why I think this is so important is that we've talked before about obviousnesses, right? And how words that we use often, we tend to think we understand perfectly and that everyone else is having the exact same experience when we talk about a particular concept or word. And I think this is one of the best examples of A, that it is clear we are not talking necessarily about the same thing when we talk about something like mental proliferation or rumination, and B, the act of deconstructing it, understanding it, historicizing it, those things that you're so interested in doing with your work, gives us insights we wouldn't otherwise have. So essentially, I want to take myself and the listeners into the way your mind works when you come up against an idea that you don't understand or you think you don't understand well, and what happens, what kind of things emerge for you.
Yeah. So first of all, I'm not sure Papancha is a good example of this.
Okay.
because one, it's not actually translated as rumination. So that's a kind of additional step to make, to first say it is about proliferation and then say, well, what we mean by proliferation today is rumination. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the case. Like, I actually think that's a defensible case, but it's certainly not the traditional translation of this term. And so, but I think what you're saying is really important, because we can, maybe Papancha is a good example for what we're talking about because its meaning is debated right now. And so we can actually see in real time the process by which we agree what a word means. So when we talk about obviousnesses, like a good word in this sense is actually one that's treated in Concept and Reality in this book that I'm referring to, which is, what does the word I mean? Well, actually, I is always contextual, right? It depends who says it. It depends on a lot of other things. And it's so widely used that we think it's a really simple word. But in fact, it's not, right? And so a word like I is on the opposite side of the spectrum of Papancha, because when you use the term Papancha, everyone thinks, well, I have no idea what that means. And basically everyone, you know, even people that are deeply interested in these kind of books don't agree on what it means, right? Whereas the word I just never gets this kind of treatment, which is that people don't ever say, well, what do you mean by I? Everyone just assumes that that is a coherent and obvious term to use. I'm not sure if I'm being super clear, but like,
Can I reiterate just to make sure I got it? So
go for
it. I have two goals with my question. One is to understand this polyterm. And the second is to uncover the ways that you think about a concept and the process by which you deconstruct it or historicize it and so on. So these are two goals I have. And so you're saying that the word Papancha is not a good example of this obviousness issue.
Yes.
And what you do when you discover one of these things. And the word I and the concept I is a much better one. It's this short term. Everybody actually thinks they understand what they mean when they're doing this first person eyeing. And instead, we don't. And your claim is that we actually have to do a lot of work to understand what's behind. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think if we started with something like rumination within psychology, for example, that might be a good example of where a term is used and it's used so frequently that we all think we know what it means. But in fact, like, it may not be as obvious as it seems from how frequently it's used, right? And Papancha is like a kind of, without going into what exactly it means at this stage, although we will do that later, it's used quite frequently in the early Pali Suttas in a way that you're kind of supposed to know what it means. And this actually makes it particularly hard to figure out what the translation is, because a word that's really commonly used, we tend not to have to define, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're simple words, right? That just means that they're commonly used and we think that we understand them well, right?
Yeah, I get it. And I think that for me, one of the things that often happens when we're working together and you're trying to explain to me a new concept or a thing that you're learning from the Buddhist texts, what happens often is that I get my own insight because it uncovers for me how little I know and how much I take for granted. And so this very process of doing this, what do I imagine I know about this? What historically has happened? And then the other thing that I think is really important to highlight is how you think about translation and what's going on when you read a translation of a text, whether it's ancient Greek or this. So can you tell me a little bit about how that also is involved?
Yeah, so I think I got interested in this term by reading the texts, like parts of the Pali Canon that are about dependent origination, and just seeing some footnotes that are like, no one knows how to translate this term. And basically, that's a really interesting thing to me, because in other places, it's kind of said, well, this term just means mental proliferation. So I got interested in the history of this translation, right? Which is basically to say, when did this idea that mental proliferation is a good rendering of this term occur? Because even that question, right, even like each of these things has a history, right? It's not that the word means something and that meaning is fixed. But in fact, you know, the same word has been read by different people for 2,500 years now, and different renderings have been used. And even in just the last 50 years, a new one has become popular. And so because I'm interested in historicizing things, and that's a term that means putting things into historical context, right? So, and historicizing is a thing that sometimes historians do, but not always, basically. So, sorry.
I was going to say is tell me even more, like what I want to know is even more about what historicizing means. It's not just putting it into its temporal context, saying, hey, this is a term that was used in the, I don't know, Renaissance to mean blah, blah, blah. It's a process of contextualizing much more than just a date, right? And I think that's so important that I'd want you to just give me even more details about what historicizing means to you.
Yeah, historicizing means going back through, in this case, it's a word, right? And so what has this word meant at different times? And when different people are using this word in different ways, like why were they doing that? So it's kind of got I have a bunch of assumptions when I start historicizing a term. One is that there is no fixed meaning of a term, that it's always contextual. Two is that over its history, it's probably changed, right? And as a general trend, it's usually safe to assume that any given word has gone from some fairly concrete meaning to becoming something more abstract. There's no kind of precise way that you can say for certain that's the case. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, sometimes words get more concrete or something like that. But as a general point, when you go back to the very beginning, words, their etymological roots tend to be rooted in quite basic things that are relatively concrete, let's say, and then they come to be more abstract over their usage. It's also the case that different people at different times have just different interests, right? So there's going to be all this historical context around who's using it at what times, right? And so, and why they're interested in this term. So there's like also a lot of theory of mind going on, right, for any of these things that have an old history. And I think it's important to point out that, you know, unless it's like a term that just got coined yesterday on social media or something like that, it is a term that is very likely to have a long history. So, you know, many of the words that we use in English are going to go back into at least, you know, some kind of Germanic thing or else some kind of French thing, which then leads back to Latin. And many of those will even go back further into Proto-Indo-European. And that's true of every word. It doesn't mean that we always have the etymological history of a word, but common words will be at a minimum several thousand years old, and that they will have had different meanings, emphases, and contexts in which they are used over time. And for some words, that becomes particularly obvious. You know, political words, whether it's like conservative or liberal or things like that, those have switched meanings many, many times over the centuries, just over like three centuries or something like that. They can come to mean almost the opposite of what they once meant. So there's a need for caution when you go back and read old texts. I'm certainly not always the best person to do that, because I think, you know, you may need really a lot of knowledge of a language and linguistics and things like that in order to understand how a word, you know, that looks like a word we use today, what it actually meant in, let's say, ancient Rome or in 9th century England or whatever, you know.
And so tell me why that matters, because I would say, you know, okay, all words have their histories and we can all acknowledge that they were used differently a few hundred years ago than they do right now. But if we all know that we're using this term currently in this form, why would it matter that these words themselves have these complex histories embedded in cultures, embedded in time, and so on?
It's a great question. And I think in most cases, it doesn't matter. Or like, let's say when we're speaking normally to each other, we don't need to go into the etymology of every word that we're using. That would neither be something that we want to do nor something that we're like capable of doing. And it would cause the conversation to stop, basically. So it's important that we're not always doing this. At the same time, you can't understand anything that's produced by evolution just by looking at its current incarnation. So in the same way that we can't look at a given animal, I've got a pigeon that's staring at me from outside the window. And if I look at that pigeon and I think, okay, well, how, you know, what is a pigeon? That was kind of the attitude of, I think, biologists, you know, before Darwin. There's this idea of perfection, the idea that these species are going towards some period where they stop changing, because even before Darwin, they had a notion that things are changing. And so you might just think, well, they're moving towards something. Now, Darwin is a pretty decisive blow against that teleological view of evolution. You know, it's kind of the opposite in some ways of something like orthogenesis, which is this idea that maybe all this change is towards something. And Darwin is like, no, this is, it's articulating, it's moving from one thing to another. There's no kind of timeless element where a species just bursts into existence fully formed without any predecessors, right? It's got this lineage back probably to the beginning of life. In fact, I think we can say that with a fairly strong degree of certainty, right? That there's a single origin of all life, and that all the kingdoms and domains, etc., all come from this original central dogma or whatever it is of biology, right? That there are so many things in common in living things that they had to have a single origin. But the point is that in order to understand a particular individual of a species, we kind of have to understand the species. And in order to understand the species, we have to understand what came before it. We can't look at the hand and think that it's for grasping and that's how it came about. That doesn't actually explain the many, many steps in evolution that were required to get from something like a fish, which, you know, we have in our lineage somewhere, to a hand, right? It's not that some kind of guiding, you know, concept of handedness comes about and then evolution is going towards that, right? It's a series of really small changes over a long period of time that produce this under, you know, the Darwinian understanding of variation and selection, right? So what I'm saying is that words operate in exactly the same way, which is to say that if you deeply want to understand a word, you can't actually do so just by its current usage. That doesn't give you insight into what the original meaning of the word is. And you might then just say, well, why does the original meaning of the word matter? Because this is how we now use it. And what I'm saying is that a lot gets hidden in a word over time. I think, so Wittgenstein makes this point in the 20th century. It's certainly in Nietzsche, and it's in a kind of inchoate form in Schopenhauer. This idea that words are not hard boundaried categories. They're more like bags that we just kind of stick things into. And, you know, even just me saying, you know, tracing back this idea of what defines a word through Wittgenstein to Nietzsche and then back to Schopenhauer, who seems to have an earlier form of this idea of what comes to be understood as family resemblances within Wittgenstein as a better way of understanding words than something like categories, right? Then that's like an application of the kind of reasoning that I'm talking about, which is a historicizing reason. So we've talked before about the historical sciences. We've also talked about dependent origination. And this is a way of applying that. Now, I realize I'm still not answering the question. Why would we want to understand a word in this way? I think the answer is that it can provide a huge amount of insight into what's going on, why this word is the way it is. It can kind of destabilize the word in a way that allows us to better understand it. So we may settle back to a definition that we were already implicitly using when we define a word or historicize it, which is sort of like defining it over time, maybe. But it enriches our understanding of the word, and I think it gives us insight into what's going on in culture, and it gives us like context that's actually required to understand why we use a word in a certain way.
Yeah, I think it's not an easy question or answer, and I appreciate the thinking through from an evolutionary lens, because I think it is actually, you know, you could also ask the question from a biologist, why does it matter these lineages if we can look at this organism and just study now its functions and so on? And so I think, yeah, the conditions under which the word changes its meaning or comes to fit a context and sort of co-evolves with the people using it over time, it gives us these incredible, for me, insights and lenses into how we make meaning to begin with, right? And how we shifted and why we shifted and so on. And so I think these processes of historicizing, making them more and more explicit so people understand what's behind it and the motivation is really important.
Yeah, and I think it's a really good question. Why do we care about the biological history of something? Well, the answer to that is basically Darwin, right? Which is that if you don't do this process, you can come out with a very misguided understanding of what's going on under evolution. You can stick for hundreds or thousands of years with the idea that either God created these kind of categories that we call species, and then these lower level categories that we call varieties, or if, as the evidence mounts against that kind of hard delineation, we come up with the understanding that, well, maybe these things are changing, but maybe God has a plan for them, to the Darwinian understanding, which is a disturbing one, which is that there is no plan, right? There's this kind of emergent property. And, you know, it is the case that species evolve. If you define a species as animals that can reproduce or not reproduce, or flowers or whatever it is, with each other, then of course these things do diverge sufficiently that they can no longer reproduce with each other. But where is that line? Well, actually, you know, Darwin spends a lot of the early part of The Origin of Species trying to find that line, and he finds that essentially he can't, which is like quite an important insight. And I think it's an insight that's required for him to really get into his understanding of natural selection and how it's working. And so the answer to the question of why historicize within biology is because if you don't do it, you actually can't understand how things work. Now, maybe you and I are not biologists and we don't need to understand how that works, but the reasoning is important because, as I was trying to suggest, a lot more occurs under roughly speaking, Darwinian evolution than we might normally think about. So a term like proliferation or rumination, as we kind of started the conversation with, this idea that something called depression is caused by or linked to, and you can correct me and explain the research on that in a second, but basically that depression, something called depression is caused by something called rumination. Let's just start with that, or you can set it up in a different way in a second. Well, what is depression? You know, what is rumination? And those are both things that are, as what I'm thinking of is something like cultural artifacts, or maybe even better, like forms of, because they are lifelike, right? They kind of reproduce themselves, that these terms actually are contextual and that they are subject to evolution. And so if we want to understand a proposition like rumination causes depression, we actually have to understand what is meant by those. And to understand what is meant by those is actually more than just understanding the dictionary definition. Although if you're using a dictionary, a good dictionary like the OED, that often has, as a critical part of it, a history of how that word is used, not just in English over several centuries, but back into the etymology of the word, right?
Yeah, and I love that you brought it back to thinking about words like rumination and depression, because this is exactly where we can see how important these words are and how we're using them now. Never mind the word cause. I mean, even the word cause and what we mean by it, as opposed to other things like co-evolve or co-arise. Cause is a really powerful word. But depression, you know, we used to call it hysteria or hysterical women, right? Or melancholia. And each of those words or the sort of combinations of those often were only labels you would use for women, for example, right? So this is a very easy example of how a phenomenon out in the world, like feeling super sad, not being able to get out of bed, not being able to sleep or sleeping too much, etc., these set of symptoms are called as a group depression now, and they're called different things earlier. And that means that also had an implication for how one treats depression, how whether one gives pills versus, you know, a massage, etc., right? So I think this is why it's so important, because we have this idea, and certainly we have it in medical sciences and psychological sciences, that these things are entities out there that we can act upon in very concrete ways, and we will get a result. And that's what curing depression is through SSRIs, for example, and so on. And so when we look at these, the evolution of these words, what it gives us is an idea that these processes are much more complex and are not, they're not fixed. They change according to all the things that you've just talked about. And thinking of them as evolutionary processes, I think, is really, really important. And I think gives us a lens that isn't often used. So yeah, that's why I really think it's great to dive into it.
Let me ask you, does psychology have an account of when depression began? Or is it understood that these kind of conditions just went under different names over a period of time? You know, I suppose it comes back to the DSM and stuff like that, right? Because there is a question, right? Are these things new or are they not new, right?
So, I mean, there are some people, and there is a history of psychology kind of approach to thinking about these ideas. And the real difficulty about answering something like, has depression always been around and so on, is exactly what you mentioned. With the DSM, we have now a set of symptoms that we're now calling, you know, the truth Bible here. And then we are able to look at somebody and say, you know, yes or no to these set of symptoms, you've got depression or not. If we didn't have that set of symptoms or that standardized way of asking the questions, we can't actually map on to prevalence rates and so on in societies, right? And not a minor issue, because it's like anything, including ADHD and all sorts of autism and so on. We think of these things as entities, depression, that we have inside of ourselves that we can get an assessment of from some objective person out there. And so we should be able to ask the question, has depression been around in the same way over millennia? But we can't, because our observation, our measurements are determine that prevalence rates almost entirely, right? And so I think it's a really important lens to think about.
Yeah, I mean, my kind of, I could be completely wrong about this, but there's this anatomy of melancholy, right? That's written, when is it, like 17th century, I think? Is it Burton?
I don't know when it's written, actually.
But there's that idea that maybe it starts around then, or that, you know, maybe before then. There's this idea of acedia, which is like called the noonday demon, I think, in the Middle Ages. And there's kind of an idea that that might be somehow linked to depression. I mean, actually, Ludwig Fleck, The Genesis and Development of a Scientific Fact, is about the, it's hard to say what word to use. Let's just stick with genesis and development of syphilis as a disorder, right? So this takes several decades, and there's not really an understanding of what it is. There's kind of two dominant, we might call them paradigms now, because Kuhn was very influenced by this book, but two dominant understandings of what might be going on in venereal disease. And one is that it is related to sin, basically. So that's a pretty dominant understanding in the 19th century. Then in the 20th century, there starts to be this idea, well, maybe it's actually a disease that we can kind of classify. But then there's a big question of, like, is there just one disease with many different types of problem that it can cause, or are there many venereal diseases, right? And so this debate kind of rages for a long time. And what's interesting is that it really doesn't get settled definitively until the first test comes about. And so I've thought that it would be really interesting for someone much more knowledgeable about medical history than me to look at this process, like zoom out and do this for other diseases, including COVID. Because with the pandemic, you could say that what's happened is actually the same thing as happening that happened with syphilis. It's just that the loops to create a concept are much tighter. So basically, you eliminate these decades of debating. Is this a thing? Is it not a thing? Once there's a test, you can say it is a thing. And we can say in binary terms whether you've got it or not. And I think, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah,
on that,
so
that
just
question?
To make sure, first let me reflect back to make sure that I understand, because I think this is relevant to everything, basically. It goes back to why concepts are so difficult and much more problematic than we think. And so this idea that, like syphilis, in the COVID pandemic, we identified something quickly and sort of could see across the world, now that we were able to communicate with one another much faster, internet, all that. And we could point to something and say, we're all seeing the same thing, and let's organize ourselves around, you know, finding a test, first of all, and then a vaccine and so on. And so prior to this, there might also have been the emergence of other kinds of pandemic-like diseases or whatever, and we didn't recognize them as such because we didn't have the ability to talk with one another as quickly, communicate, and then work on a problem together. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that maybe the same thing that happened during COVID in terms of this gap between noticing that a lot of people seem to have this symptom to the stabilized thing that's widely agreed upon, although of course not entirely agreed upon, that COVID is a real thing, right? Is maybe it follows the same pattern as what happened with syphilis, just over a much shorter time scale. So with syphilis, there's just these like decades of debate, right? And there's these kind of schools that emerge. It is very similar to what Kuhn describes in terms of like a scientific crisis, and how the crisis gets arbitrated on this social level, and then a kind of consensus emerges. And once the consensus has emerged, then it becomes possible to say things like, well, we think that Nietzsche or Tolstoy had syphilis, you know, but that's not really, you know, that kind of reasoning is actually in some way revisionist. Yes. Because these concepts don't exist. You know, they call it different things. And when it's described, we're like, oh yeah, that's what we would now call. Another example would be like the plague of Justinian was the Black Death. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Well, it means that this thing we now call bubonic plague is the same thing that we think caused the pandemic, you know, in the Middle Ages, as well as it caused this thing that we call the Black Death. And it also caused this thing several hundred years before, almost 1,000 years before, that we call the Plague of Justinian, which is talked about. But and maybe we will come up with persuasive evidence that it is the same thing. But you see what I mean? Like, if you're in Justinian's time, you can't say this is bubonic plague, or you can't say that this is the Black Death, because those things haven't happened yet. You know what I mean? So it's like, I hope I'm not confusing people as to whether I think these things are real, because I do think they're real. It's just a question of like how these conceptual categories work and how we remap the past on the basis of present knowledge, right?
I think it's very clear, and it isn't about, you know, obliterating something that was there, or the opposite, making it so. I think this is the power of thinking about history and context. And it's exactly relevant again to something like depression, because it's only through this sort of disease model of psychopathology that we now think about how to treat these pathologies, if you want. And it's that model came from medicine, right? And that model came from a motivation, a human motivation, to make a field look more legit. And so the field of psychology and even psychiatry is looking to medicine and saying, this is what we want to do. We want to take this approach, this structure of science, and put it to what we do. And it's very debatable. And in fact, well, I won't get into the debate around whether something like depression is a disease, or addiction is a disease, and what harms are done by looking at it as such versus looking at it as something different that we could think about.
Yeah. And in the historicizing mode, you would kind of say, well, what is a disease? And so that's another question that, you know, it's not like there's a category where we say, okay, this is or is not this thing. And it, because it's labeled in such a way, or it meets these conditions or whatever, these are things that you either have or don't have, as you were saying, in the DSM, on the basis usually of self-report, right? Or of questionnaire, right? But then, as you're saying, if it's a disease, then we think it's kind of by analogy, right? So we're like, well, maybe this is something like syphilis. And if it's something like syphilis, now we understand syphilis to be a bacterial infection, right? And because of the way that the 20th century played out, we have these things called antibiotics. Often you take them in pill form, although not always. And therefore, one of the characteristics of what we call a disease is that you take a pill to cure it.
Yes.
Right? And so in this case, it's almost like by analogy to this older thing that has pills, we're saying depression is that kind of thing. And therefore, the treatment for it is also that kind of thing. You're going to take a pill to cure it. And that's not to say that that's wrong. I mean, you know, there may be all kinds of reasons that it is subject to that. But it's just important that, like, this whole structure of, you know, even things that we totally consider ingrained, like, well, if you have a disease, you take a medicine, and that medicine is sold in a certain way. It comes in these blister packs. The blister packs come in cardboard. You get this thing called a prescription that's like a label on it, whatever. Like, but all of those things are evolved from earlier things, right? Like, if it's 1750 and you need medicine, it's not going to look like that, right? And so, like, I'm not really sure what my point is there, except to just say that you can see this in application when you think about questions like that. And I do think that each of these things that appears obvious, like, even just the fact that I say, well, depression is a disease or a chemical imbalance or whatever, and that means something to someone, and they can then extrapolate and generalize from that, it shows the kind of power of meaning that a lot of these metaphors or analogies have, right? Which is that They produce other obviousnesses. And I think in that way, they do relate to Papancha, which we brought up at the start, which is the prolific tendency of concepts, yes. Right? If I say screen addiction is a disease, you might say, well, then there should be a pill for this, or there should be a cure for this, even if you're not going to say a pill. And so that would be, I think, a good example. If you're taking the mental proliferation interpretation of Papancha, then this is a good example of a place where it's happening at the verbal level. But the Buddha's claim is that it's also happening at a much faster rate at the kind of mental mm-hmm. level. So in other words, the verbal is one level, and it's an important one. It's not. I'm not saying that the verbal is not important. In fact, some of the early descriptions of dependent origination are about quarrels and disputes. So why do verbal arguments arise? Well, the answer that the Buddha gives is that they're dependent on these other conditions, and he kind of does this backwards, what I've been calling the backward order dependent origination. In Pali, it's called against the grain, like if you stroke an animal the wrong way. And that's because it's uncomfortable. Now, what's interesting is this comfortable direction. Actually, I was thinking about this morning. Do you mind if I bring in an example
technology? No, of course not.
So one thing I was thinking about is like, okay, what's a good example of why do we call it with the grain or against the grain dependent origination? One is understood to be easy, straightforward, simple. It makes things easier, right? The other is understood to be difficult. But the difficult way, annoyingly, is the way to end suffering in the Buddhist's understanding. So let me give an example of a juncture where you could either go with the grain or against the grain. Let's say I wake up in a house and I'm like, okay, I want coffee, right? Now, I go into the kitchen and they don't have the kind of stovetop espresso mocha pot thing that I use. Instead, they have this like thing that's plugged in. It has this water on the back. It has this thing on the top. And I'm like, okay, what, you know, is this the coffee thing? How do I use this? Now, you could come to me and say, yeah, you need this capsule. You put it in the top. You do this to turn it on. You do this. You pull this thing down and then you press the button and then the coffee comes out, right? That's like an experience that, assuming you know what I'm talking about at all, that all of us have had in the last 10 years, because basically this didn't exist before 10 years ago, right? These Nespresso or whatever kind of pod things. Now, the with the grain thing that I could do is follow the procedure that you've given, essentially take it as just an obvious thing that works and a repeatable action that I can take in the future. And then over the following, whenever I get into this situation again, you know, next morning and the morning after that, I just follow the same kind of procedure that you outlined, and then it produces coffee and I'm mm-hmm. happy, right? That's with the grain. Against the grain would be something like, how does this machine work? Or like, why do you have this machine? Where did it come from? You know, like what? And I think this is like an important question. It sounds really trivial because it's like the goal is to just get the coffee. And it's like, yeah, in most cases, the goal is just to build on what's already there and just use it transparently, right? But that's not always the goal, right? Which is that there might be situations where you're like, okay, well, we seem to be, I don't know, filling up landfills with these new capsule things, which, you know, why do these capsules exist again? Well, they exist by this kind of analogy to this older Italian espresso thing where, you know, you used to have to like take coffee grounds, get them really fine, like pack them into this thing, put this steam through them, you know, do what's required to use an espresso machine or whatever. And each of these things has its own history, right? Like that machine, I have no idea how old it is, but it's obviously like a factory made thing, right? It can't be older than 100 years. I think they came to London in the 1960s. But of course, coffee was drunk before that, right? Long before that. And so there's all these kind of like steps of, you know, automating, improving, reducing the number of steps to make it easier. And so at the end of this, we can come out and just say, okay, here's the easy way to do it. And that's all we need to understand. But you can also imagine lots of situations where you're like, well, why do we do this? This coffee is actually worse than the way that I normally make it. like, why can't I just make it the old way? Like, you know, it wasn't that hard, you know, like, and I don't know. So I was just thinking about that because, like, our ability to just extend what's already there makes it very quick for this whole process to get underway, whereby this is now a thing, right? So you might object to the idea that syphilis is invented as a thing. I could see some people not being happy with that notion. They might say, yes, now there's a test for it or whatever, but it was always a thing. I could see taking that view, although you do have to understand that for hundreds of years, at least, people considered that a manifestation of sin. And if you had said anything else, like, that would have been the obviousness at the time in 1800 or whatever. Now, so the syphilis is like a more difficult example to understand, right? Because we like to have this idea that it is a thing because there's this test, right? Now, before, I have no idea how old these Nespresso things are either, but now they're everywhere, right? Like, you can just go into any store and get them. And we can agree, most people will agree, that was not the case 10 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever it is, right? This is a new thing, right? And what I'm kind of saying is that all things that we consider things are of this nature. We just can't see that they are this way. And they change over time, right? So I'm not saying that the bacteria causing syphilis or bubonic plague or whatever it is didn't exist. It's not a claim like that. Mm-hmm. It's just a claim that the way we conceptualize it does change over time. And the way that it changes is it brings things with a whole series of associations into being as a cultural sort of artifact, but also as a cultural autopoietic life form, right? Yes. Which is that they have their own kind of momentum. They seem to reproduce themselves. I'm not saying that they have agency or intelligence or something like that, but just that on some level they are well understood as living things.
Yeah.
Rather than objects.
I think you're right. And the original sort of word meme was this idea, and, you know, when people were talking about way before internet memes, they were supposed to be ideas, right? And ideas or concepts that were particularly contagious, that people very readily internalized and didn't realize that they did. And so they became these obviousnesses. And so I think what you're saying is right. And I think what's I really get what you're trying to say around the Nespresso thing. And I think what's really important about that example is also that it's social. So the engine, the engine of the proliferation is not just in our own minds, this suddenly is everywhere, but it's that we've all agreed that we're not going to say, this is stupid. I have this other kind of machine. Why do I have to get a new one? Or we had perfectly figured out for hundreds of years, right? It's this social, whether maybe it's social status, you see all these people with these pod things and suddenly hotels finally have them. And there's this, so there's this social kind of very rapid internalizing of a value around these concepts as well that is really important for them to proliferate.
Yeah, and I will just say, going historicizing memetics, that it is a thing that, you know, Dawkins and others came up with in the 20th century. It's also a thing that's now out of favor in the new wave of cultural evolutionary theory. And it has its limitations, and basically it's understood to not be that good of a theory. And that's another reason that we kind of, you know, I was just thinking as I was saying that about why these are like life forms. Like, we talk about dead languages, right? And live languages, whether they're spoken or not. If they're not spoken, they're dead languages, right? And we use this kind of understanding a lot, that there is a kind of lifelike quality to living cultural practices, right? Like, I mean, we talk about things living or dying off.
Yeah, they're the ones that survived, like, right? That. The living are the ones that survived.
Yeah. And I want to make sure that, like, I don't, even though I have a personal antipathy towards these coffee pod things, they're not actually any better or worse. Like, they, in specific regards, they might be. Maybe in terms of, like, waste, they're worse. Or maybe in terms of something else, they're worse. But it's like, it's not like, you know, like, I could be in a house where I don't know how to use the Nespresso machine, but someone could also be in my house and like, there's a lot of steps required in using just like a simple cafetière or whatever. You have to know the ratios. Sure. Like there's like these trade-offs in each of them that is not like a straightforward one. And so this kind of historicizes and problematizes just the progress narrative as a thing, right? But it's also like, there are lots of practices that were probably super common and super popular in previous centuries that just we don't do anymore. And they used implements that were like, we don't know what this thing was for, you know? Yeah. There seemed to be a lot of them, you know? We try to map them onto things that we now know about. You know, I think this has been done in many cases with certain types of stones and things like that, that indigenous people leave a lot of, and we think, oh, well, it must be money. And it's like, well, that's because we have this strong bias to think that money is a thing. Like, I'm not saying that it's definitively is or is not, like, I don't have any judgment on that. But like, what I mean is, it's very easy and tempting to collapse things into our current conceptual categories, right? Like, we have this tendency. It's not even a tendency. There is a pleasure in recognition, and there's a pleasure in applying the concepts that we have and saying, oh, this is like something that I know. Yeah. And therefore, we have a tendency to read things in those terms, even when that may not be a good explanation of why something is happening.
Yes. And I think that the importance of historicizing and thinking very clearly about what the process is key, because it forces us into a mindset that gives us different entry points and forces us to take those different entry points as a methodology, if you will. Because if we don't, it doesn't come natural. And so this, as you say, it's right. Pleasurable to recognize things, or we just don't know we're doing it constantly. That's how our brains work, is to do these kinds of categorizing very quickly on the fly so that we sense make without stopping every millisecond. And so I think that the example of the coffee maker and then going into things like money and coins, you know, might seem superficial, but as we start thinking about artifacts that bring in so many of our value systems as a culture and so on, and we put that onto past civilizations or societies and so on, it problematizes everything, right? So I just think that making explicit this methodology is really important, and also maybe making it explicit to ourselves and listeners that part of what we're doing here in dialogue is trying to uncover some of the ways we can better think against the grain and the kinds of insights we get as a result.
Yeah, and because there are obviously dangers from treating things transparently or this kind of unconscious mode of just extending things. You know, the classic, I was just following orders excuse comes right. out of this mode, right? And I think it's important to think about this coinage thing, because we talk about coining new terms. I think it's in Nietzsche where he basically talks about, he's looking at ancient Greece and saying that at that time, a lot of these words that we now use transparently are newly minted. And so they're basically like these shiny coins where they have this liveness that they lose as they get kind of abstracted and used more commonly and things like that. And that what we now use as these words that were very vivid become kind of dulled or like worn. Basically, it's like this idea of like a worn currency. And I don't know, it's just something that I've thought about. So that's another reason to do this kind of historicizing, looking at the etymology of a word, is it does bring it to life in a way that it may have ceased to be alive for you. Yes. It's a technique that Nietzsche does, and I think Heidegger also takes it from Nietzsche to some degree. And I think it's important to say that this is itself a technique that Nietzsche practiced. So The genealogy of morality is a great example of taking a concept that seems obvious, which is morality, which is we all know what good and evil are. And, you know, of course, in good, beyond good and evil as well, he's problematizing these basic ideas and showing how they cannot have been there from the start. They cannot have been transparent the way that they are now, because this could never have gotten off the ground. There's just these contradictions that exist in the earliest evidence that we have that mean that they had to come together somehow. And we can't understand them, to return to this earlier point, in their finalized form. We can only understand them by looking at their origins. And so we don't always have the luxury of being able to look at everything's origins, but the further we can get back, the clearer it will be how something came into being and what it is and what its uses are or its affordances or potentialities. Like, and again, this is not something that I advocate doing all the time. Like, it might be the case that, you know, you're cooking a meal and the last thing you want to know about is how your knife was made. You want to be able to use that knife as if it's a tool transparently. I mean, it is a tool, right? So you want to be able to use it transparently to achieve the goal that you've got, which is to cut the carrots and onions and celery or whatever it is. You don't need to know the provenance of the knife. You don't need to know the history. You don't need to know why it's weighted that way. You don't need to know how it relates to the Acheulean tool set or whatever tens of thousands of years ago. You just want the knife to work, right? And if it stops working, then maybe you get more interested in what went wrong with that knife or something like that. So it's not something you should be doing all the time, but there are many situations where we should probably be thinking more clearly about what kinds of metaphors, what kinds of language we're using, what it means, and where it's going, right?
Absolutely. I think, yes, and we can go into many examples of Nietzsche and others who have shown us how wrong we are in terms of our obviousnesses and the usefulness of realizing that. But two things. First of all, it's really weird that the coinage thing is like coining a term or minting is the metaphor for like the actual money thingy and then also these new words or phrases that we use that are incredibly valuable in terms of efficiency and so on, and this value is exchanged. I just find that interesting, the etymology of the word coin.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's in the Axial Age, I think. I could be wrong about this, but I think money doesn't really come together until that kind of period that he's talking about, right? So maybe 1000 BC to 500 BC, that is when a lot of places start to get money, and there's some innovations in terms of how gold is separated from silver in Lydia by Croesus. I don't know how to say his name, but that these things do feel linked to me in a way that I think is worth thinking about. It may also be that both money and something like definitions of words are coming together with the cultures encountering each other as they are increasingly doing in the late Bronze Age, basically. I don't know.
And there is something about that metaphor of value exchange and using metaphor or terms and using nuance. So you and Maggie talked about this in your last podcast about how much she enjoyed coining as a digital anthropologist, current digital anthropologist, how much joy she gets from coining terms. And that's because she sees the value of seeing something that's happening out in the world. Other people have not quite seen it the way she has. And so coining a term first helps so that she could explain what she's seeing. And also then it helps the conversation continue on because she's been able to label something as the dark forest, for example, in the internet or something like that. And everyone can start talking about the same thing and we can be pointing to it and agreeing to it. And so in the same way, when we have, you know, money and coins that we can now all agree mean the same thing and have the same value across contexts and so on, there is this value exchange that it's more efficient. But we, of course, forget that the damn coin is not the valuable thing in and of itself, that it represents something else, right?
Yes. And as you say, there's a kind of consensus around the value of money is critically important, and that money is itself fungible, right? It's exchangeable. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it's an abstraction. And I think that, as we said earlier on in the conversation, nouns tend to get more abstract, as do verbs over time. And they then come to contain more and more things, right? And so our most basic words, I mean, the word I, you know, may be a good one to use for Buddhists, but like a word like set or put, these basic words that we have in English, when you look at the dictionary definitions, they just go on and on and on mm-hmm. and on, because they now contain multitudes, right? In terms of ways they've been used over many, many, over long periods and what they mean today. It's not just that they have this long history with containing a bunch of things, but that they actually are incredibly complex, you know, and very hard to translate in many cases, the most basic words, especially across, you know, let's say language families or something like that. It might not be that hard for us to render a single word in French, but or German, but that's because English is quite closely related to those languages, right? Whereas some category that's super basic in Nahuatl or whatever might be really difficult, and it might take dozens of words or something to render in English. That could be completely wrong. But I was just thinking, yeah, there is something about this level of abstraction that's going on in that period. And yeah, Nietzsche, as we've said before, points out that all words are abstract, right? That all concepts equate the unequal, right?
Yes.
Which is that the oak tree or whatever contains this potentially infinite number of individual trees, right? And it allows us to use one word to refer to all of them. I guess the other thing I was thinking of is another thing that's happening during that period is Hesiod is listing off the gods in this way that I really feel is a state project. I've actually done a very small amount of digging to find out if anyone else agrees with this. And yes, there is at least one classicist who's basically saying Hesiod is listing the gods as a kind of way of getting agreement about what these gods are. Because you can imagine that before there are gods for abstract concepts, they're just gods for everything.
Right.
Right. And actually, there's some evidence of this in the kind of oak and stone stuff that I think it comes up in Socrates and a few other places. This idea that our ancestors, as in the ancestors of the ancient Greeks, basically worshipped individual stones and trees, right?
And do you think...
And that potentially each tree had a name and was a god.
Right, you know? Right.
Sorry.
No. Don't be sorry. I wonder if this is a similar impulse that the Buddhists or the Buddha himself were activating when they were trying to put terms, so eight terms for, you know, whether it's mental proliferation or different mind states, basically, right? And if right. there's some similar thing when you're naming gods and those gods have a relation to your emotions or motivation states or relations with others and so on, and they're personified or they're summarized or conceptualized as gods, versus what the Buddhists were doing also, this incredible fine-grained naming of processes that are mental processes that they noticed as they studied more and more their internal environment. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I think it probably is true that it's trying to come to some kind of agreement with each other about what's going on with this newfound proliferation. And I am going to try and argue that this proliferation thing is new. It actually requires, it is itself a cultural artifact or whatever you want to call it. It's subject to cultural evolution. The self, as well as proliferating concepts and abstractions, are probably relatively recent. We can see some of them coming together, and especially in this late Bronze Age. And yeah, the late Bronze Age.
But just before, can you restate that? You are saying, when you mean relatively new, you're talking about the late Bronze Age, and you are saying that this propensity or even capacity to externalize and socially come to a consensus about what? About aspects of the self or aspects of the world and self in combination is just starting to emerge during this period. I just want a bit more specificity there.
I don't think it's the case that cultural proliferation starts there, right? Because you have these tool sets that get proliferated even between different Homo species, right? And so there is proliferation at the physical level. What I think is new is, to some degree, the prolific tendency between minds, but that's probably older. So I think that that probably, I would not know exactly how to date that, but I'm guessing that's many thousands of years old, at least, if not much older. But what seems to be new is the ability to proliferate within a single mind. And that's what I think is going on in this period leading up to the Buddha. By the time of the Buddha, there's something like a modern self coming about. And it's not fully modern. It's not, you know, the Buddha is not exactly like us in kind of mindset and things like that. And that's not to say that he's more primitive either. It's abstract enough that it can kind of untether this prolific element. And this kind of untethering happens all the time in evolution, right? You know, you could say that like there's not really life on, you know, there's not really animals on land before this certain point, and then they kind of start going up, but they have these limitations, and then eventually this whole lung thing happens, and now they're not tethered to this ocean thing anymore.
Right, but can I go back to this? So, because I'm sorry, my mind was a bit blown there, and I do not want to let this go. You're suggesting that in the period when the Buddha lived, there's almost a potential transition period. And it could be that what he was doing, and I definitely want to go back to this idea of the kind of nobility or those who had the means and time to think about these kinds of things are often the ones that begin some kind of innovation in mind, and then it goes to the masses. But I don't want to yet go to that. Is this a well-known idea or hypothesis? Because I've never heard it, that the Buddha in some ways was responding to this potential transition in the modern mind, and the suffering that was being experienced was almost a new experience because of this shift in potential whatever mind-brain kind of organization. And so it is he who was, and, you know, his compatriots, who were investigating the mind in this way because it was actually reorganizing almost in that moment. Is that correct?
That is definitely what I'm arguing. Others have pointed in this direction. Julian James, of course, is one of them. Carl Jaspers also, you know, gets this idea of the axial age, that a bunch of stuff is changing in this period, and it's partly because of all this philosophy is coming together, as well as religions are coming together. Many religions, what we now call religions, many cultural kind of histories that can be parts of creation accounts, or they can be parts of what we now call religions, which is itself a problematic category that's relatively recent, but they have this idea of a kind of Edenic state, right? Garden of Eden. And it's ended by knowledge of good and evil, basically.
Right.
So a conceptual innovation. I'm arguing that, yeah, something similar is happening with the Buddha, that basically this prolific tendency, this tendency for concepts to come untethered from the reality and produce suffering on their own in a kind of self-perpetuating way, is new. And it's also related to a layer of abstraction. And this is why I'm interested in Luria right now, because this cognitive development thing, you know, he's going into very remote parts of the new Soviet Union at the time and looking at the trade-offs involved with getting the kind of abstraction that you get from living in the built environment. No one knows exactly whether it's education, whether it's, you know, it could be all kinds of things. It could be education, it could be the buildings, it could be all kinds of things. But before a certain point, people are much more resistant to abstraction. And there could be a lot of things going on in there. But, you know, you hear this example about they kind of refuse to do syllogisms, right?
Yes.
This idea that you could say bears above this latitude are all white, and I'm asking you about bears in this particular area that's north of this latitude. What color are they? And they say, I don't know.
Right.
I haven't been there. And it seems like to the people who are asking them these questions, a kind of either stubbornness or maybe stupidity, although I've always wondered whether they were actually secretly laughing at these idiots who are asking them the questions.
Right.
But it's a different mindset, right? To just say, I refuse to go down that abstraction.
Yes.
Route, because you and I are totally trained in this, you know, abstracting. We are totally comfortable working with abstractions. So if you invented a new term, you know, I mean, programming essentially does this, right? Like, let A equal this. And you're like, okay, that's what it equals, you know? And we don't have any problem doing these kind of substitutions. Whereas for other people, the idea of abstracting that, like, all bears above this latitude are white, and I'm just like, not, you know, until I go there, I'm just,
I have no
idea. There's absolutely no way I'm accepting that premise, you know? And it's like, and they would do things like this sometimes.
Yes.
They would say, you know, have you seen them? And then Laurie would be like, no. And then they're like, why are you talking about this? Like, literally, like, why? But the what's important to say here is that, you know, it's not like it has costs, abstraction, right? So if you were to take Luria and just stick him on the Eurasian steppe, he'd be dead within a couple
exactly.
of days.
Yes.
Right. And so they have a form of intelligence that there's absolutely no way that he has. Right. And so there is an important trade-off. And it's not like learning these abstractions doesn't have costs. It does have costs. Right?
Absolutely.
One of the things that comes out of this research is the fact that these people don't see the Ebbinghaus illusion and other visual illusions, right? And this has been replicated across other societies that don't live in a built environment, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So other indigenous cultures, even in the Amazon or like, you know, Australia, places that are nothing like Eurasia, right? And it's basically like if they are not raised in a kind of like westernized environment or whatever. And of course, the West is its own category
yes.
that has all kinds of problems. But you know what I mean. And so we're going to stick with the West at the moment. That basically the children of these people that do grow up in the built environment end up getting the same visual illusions that Westerners have, right? So it's not like I'm saying visual illusions are this huge cost that's imposed by like living in the built environment. But just that things that we think are as basic as, well, everyone sees these kind of weird arrow diagrams like this or these circles as, you know, it's hard to see which one's bigger or whatever it is. But things as basic as that, that seem to be a part of perception that's built into perception, are not built into perception. They're
that's
actually
right.
learned. And so, you know, and learned in ways that we have no understanding of, right? So
yeah, absolutely. And I do think this is essential to get into because it touches on three maybe really important elements. One, this nativist approach to this is just natural. This is how we are born. This is biologically based, this perceptual system that we have. I think there's so much to unpack there. How much is not innate, whatever we call innate, and the importance of understanding that behind that is this idea of how much we do to fit with our environment and how much this sort of structural coupling happens in cultures over just one or two generations. It doesn't have to take so many, you know, thousands of years and so on, right? And so I think understanding the extent to which the biological basic perceptual system is flexible and malleable and adjusted to the very local context is so crucial.
Yeah, and Luria, we're going to have to get into that at some point, this idea that there's a kind of lengthening, a neural
yes.
lengthening that has costs as well, which is that essentially it makes you slower at doing things, but you can then relearn it. And all kinds of horrible experiments were done on this in the 19th and early 20th century, like taking eyes off of animals and rewiring them and things like that. And, you know, essentially, like, if you do that to an amphibian, they can't rewire their vision.
Right.
You know, this idea of we put on glasses that flip things upside down and humans are like, oh, we can just like learn to function this way. Like amphibians can't do that. So like, but amphibians are probably faster at certain kinds of processing than we are, you know? So it's like there's...
And they don't require that flexibility. Whereas we, now scattered across the globe, requiring different adaptations to very different environments, are better suited to those different environments. And lizards are perfectly fine in Arizona, and then, you know, they don't need to be going anywhere else. Yeah, so I think that part is really important, thinking through that. The other part that Luria's work is so important to think about is, again, back to this intersubjectivity of cognition that we do know, and you mentioned it just earlier, and about a half an hour ago, where you talked about probably this shared understanding of motivations and concepts that we need to work together with. There was there for hundreds, if not thousands of years before we had this sense of self and this individual mind and so on, and that idea and concepts that arise within an individual mind. But way before that, we had these shared understandings, right? And Luria's work is very important for that kind of developmental understanding of intersubjectivity and how it's not just an evolutionary, probably a precursor to individual cognition, but it's developmentally so as well. So I really wanted to think through with you about that. And then the final thing I just wanted to sort of bookmark for us is, and this might come out very jumbled, is this idea that you've put forth as a hypothesis, I think, that pulls together what we've talked about today, which is that cultures that have monotheism, or that emerged and developed a monotheistic type of religious system, it may be that what drove that, or what co-arose with that, was this emergent sense of individual self and individual untethered minds. And that those cultures who have these, what is the opposite of monotheism? Polytheism. Those more polytheistic.
Yeah, or animus.
Yeah, exactly. So when we think about, you know, places like, well, India, I guess, they have these religious systems that were polytheistic, and as it was way long till right now, right? And that may be also correlated with this sense of a collective of minds as the basic unit of how our minds work, and a collective of cells and a collective of parts within our minds, right? And the interrelations between that sort of externalized religious system and our experience of our minds, interconnected versus very independent. Does that ring bells to you, and can you say that better?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one that probably Ted Slingerland's database might be helpful at answering, this religious database, to try and figure out whether there are correlations like that. They wouldn't surprise me, and I think it's important questions to ask, even though I'm sure that the answers will be quite complex. At the same time, there is this really intense focus. I'm reading the Old Testament right now, and in Deuteronomy, it's like, you know, there's you really got to remember to do certain things or you're going to get stoned to death, basically. And so there's, you know, that'll produce selection pressure over not a very long time. You know, that's direct selection pressure if there's a death penalty for something. There's something else I just wanted to say, which just about this obviousness thing. Like, I think that the more transparent or obvious something seems, the more problematic it can be. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it is always problematic, but I think that you get this sense in Nietzsche and in some other writers that basically we should be very cautious of those things that seem most obvious. And it's not because we can step to some third place that's outside of any ideology or whatever and see things quote unquote objectively, because I don't think that's possible either. But it's more just like becoming aware how these things form and what produces the feeling of obviousness and what the feeling of obviousness means. And that goes back to Althusser, you know, saying that ideologies impose obviousnesses on the people that hold those ideologies. And he doesn't say that because there is a non-ideological standpoint. He says it because some ideologies allow you to see that they are ideologies, whereas the kind of default position, the with the grain position, if you will, in Buddhist terms, is to see obvious things as just being true,
right?
Essentially.
Yeah. And I think I think we can go on for another hour or two, but just to wrap this part up, I do think that part of the strengths, the advantages of using the approach that you're building with neither nor, this methodology for thinking through these obviousnesses and doing it with others and having an experience of questioning and uncovering our own minds and the way that they are apprehending concepts and using them in our world and the way that we agree or disagree with others about that is so important to continue to speculate about our obviousnesses and the places that they independently we get into these kind of suffering places because of them, and also our disciplines, our sciences, our histories, our art are influenced by the ability or lack thereof of uncovering these obviousnesses.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's important just to say, yeah, it relates to the question, you know, in the Buddhist terms about individual suffering. And we will need to come back to individualism.
Yes.
At some point. There's a lot of questions about when it comes together. I mean, there's this Fichte thing with the ich. There's Montaigne, who's, you know, doing this very self-conscious portrait of himself. Albrecht Dürer, there's, you know, arguably Augustine and earlier instances as mm-hmm. well of this kind of, and certainly in parts of ancient China and ancient Greece, you see these tendencies towards a fairly intense type of individualism. And so it's certainly not like it's invented by the German idealists or something like that, but it's just interesting to think about when it becomes a kind of dominant or popular mode. And for the intersubjectivity thing, I think we're probably going to have to read that Daniel Dorr book about the imagination.
Yes.
That's when every time you bring it up, I'm like, I think I just need to read that book, actually. So
let's do that.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Until next time. Bye.
Okay. Until next time. Bye. This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.